Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is novelist and freelance writer, Dan Morin. Dan, welcome to the show.
Pleasure to be here, John. Thanks for having me.
I've been wanting to have you on the show for a long time. It's amazing our paths haven't crossed more, but I've been a big admirer of your writing for years. For the listeners, you are a novelist, freelance writer, and a prolific podcaster. You've written for Tidbits, Fast Company, Popular Science, Yahoo Tech, and Tom's Guide. You were a senior editor for Macworld for years and continue to write the awesome Stay Foolish column every Friday. And today you write for Six Colors and also host several popular podcasts, which we'll get into in the second half of the show. But I want to ask you, I'm always curious about how people arrive where they have arrived. And I know you from early Macworld days in print. Mm-hmm. But tell me before that, tell me about your early years and your career interests way back.
We'll cast our minds back to the heady days of, let's say, 2002 or so, when I was freshly graduated from college. I went to school to get an English degree because writing was the thing that I had always been the most excited about. And the English degree seemed not so rigorous that I wouldn't have time to do other things. At the same time, I'd always had an interest in technology. Like, ever since I was a kid, my parents got our first Mac when I was 10, and I basically dove into it head first. I had all of those great books that elucidated the crazy things you could do with your Mac, like the Mac Bible and some of David Pogue's books and all that. I really just...
The Missing Manual.
Yeah. And I voraciously devoured all of those and found all the wacky hacks, Bob Levitas's stuff, all that. So I sort of had those dueling technology and writing interests during all my teenage years. And in fact, my best friend and I at the time actually started up an electronic magazine for fantasy and science fiction in our teens. This would have been the mid-90s when the web was really just getting going. And so that was sort of my first foray into like online publishing, I guess, of any variety. I won't claim it to be particularly professional in any regard, but it was an interesting way to get a start there.
You're not the first person who's gone from English to computers to writing. I did it too.
Yeah.
Mine was physics to Apple II to writing, but
yeah. Same sequence. It's not a crazy path. It's perfectly reasonable.
It is.
So when I came out of college, I was, you know, figured I need to get a job. And, you know, they weren't just handing writing jobs to English majors right out of college at that point. So I kind of went back to computers because I had worked for a long time at a university here doing sort of ad hoc tech work, like as a gopher, basically. Like, I was the student that got hired during the summers and winter breaks to go around and haul out computer equipment, switch stuff in and out, and occasionally fix people's problems.
I mean, yes, you got to be the only one who knew what was going on with the computers.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that was something like that. I had some very good bosses there, which was great. But my interest went from there to, I started dabbling in programming a little bit at the time. Mm-hmm. And so when I got out of school, I went around looking for another job.
No, wait, back up.
Yeah.
In the early days of the Mac, it wasn't real easy to get into programming. It took a while.
No, that's true. Yeah. And at work, I was often forced to use Windows machines. But fortunately, my programming stuff was mainly web-based. So I was doing a lot of PHP at the time. And so you could kind of, especially once macOS 10 came around and you had the Unix underpinnings, it was a lot easier to do a development environment on your machine because you could run MySQL and PHP and Apache and all that stuff, which is primarily what I was doing. And there were some great packages in those early days that I would always install onto my computer and trick it out a little bit so I could do all my development there. So that was a pretty good time, actually, to be a Mac user and a programmer of sorts.
Did you fall into the Unix world on the command line?
A little bit. I still spend some time there today. I maintain my own server. And I always say of my command line skills, I always say I know just enough to be dangerous. And anything more complicated than that, I have to turn to some third party resources and get people to help me out when I inevitably screw something up.
I had a Silicon Graphics workstation at the Oak Ridge National Lab, and a friend of mine who was a real Unix guru and SGI Eric's guru, we wanted to move part of the operating system to an external drive. And we set up this Perl script. And we pored over it for hours. We looked at it in every way we could, and we tested part of it, and we finally decided it was all correct. And we ran it, and it started, the disk drive started turning, and things started happening. And then kernel panic. Then the system shut down, and then all was lost.
Oh, dear.
Because we left one dot off of our Perl line of code.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. I recently blew up my web server and then had to, like, so badly that I had to restore from a backup, which fortunately was not that old. But to start fiddling, I quickly get in over my head. And yet I decided I wanted to do a career in technology, or at least a little bit. I decided that seemed like a better place to work. So I went back to the university for a little while, my old job. And then I found another job at the university, a full-time position at the university, at a small research program, doing kind of the same stuff, fixing people's computers. I mean, it was a small program, it was 15 to 20 people. And I was responsible for a whole bunch of, like, the deployments, making websites, that kind of stuff. You could kind of get away with that in the early 2000s when you had a degree in English, because it was all sort of self-taught on the job stuff, right? Like, I taught myself how to program. I was curious about problems. So that's why I always, you know, was able to solve people's technology issues, just because, like, oh, I would just keep working at it until I figured out how to fix it. So that was that's a good grounding, really, for, you know, later a writing career in technology, because I actually, you know, had frontline firsthand experience with that kind of stuff. Granted, a lot of it was Windows, but the Mac stuff was all stuff I was doing on my own time, because all of my personal computers were Macs. You know, and I wasn't able to use one at work for a long time until I was, you know, just started bringing my laptop in on the sly so I could use my iBook and I had a PowerBook for a little while. So I was stuck in the Windows world a little bit, but was fortunate enough to be able to maintain the Mac side of my personal life.
Windows was a little bit of a trouble back then. Windows XP was a security nightmare, as I recall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was mainly what I maintained. In fact, we moved our program to Windows XP before the rest of the university was supposed to, because we kind of ran our own little fiefdom. So we thought XP was going to be better than what the heck was before it?
Windows 98.
Yeah, which was pretty old, long in the tooth by the time XP came around.
Yeah.
Anyways, I decided I wanted to get out of there eventually because I was working on these long-term tech programming, you know, website programming projects that were just never going to end. Like, it was just, I knew if I stayed there for 10 years, I would be working on the same thing. So I kind of bailed out after a few years, and I had had a little bit of success. I got a piece published in the Boston Globe about Star Wars, which I'm still to this day a big Star Wars fan. So that seemed like another natural outlet for me. And it was just enough success to give me that taste of, you know, maybe I could do writing
that
more.
That was
maybe
my next question. Usually there's some critical point, you know, that some sort of event that triggers you writing.
Yeah, that was the big one for me. I'd always been writing in the background. Like, I'd been doing stuff on the side, mainly like a little bit of just my own blog. You know, everybody in the early 2000s had their own blog. And this was my first. Fortunately, I had a friend of a friend who could put me in touch with the right editor at the Globe. And I just kind of blindly pitched. I didn't really have any idea what I was doing. And fortunately, they liked this piece. They published it in the arts section. And I thought to myself, well, maybe I can make a career out of this. So I did the time honor thing. I quit my job without having any safety net. Moved back in with my parents for about 9 months, which was a fun time. A little bit before that had happened, I emailed Jason Snell, who was then the editor-in-chief of Macworld. And he always had his email at the bottom of his front page columns, just inviting people to sort of chime in with what they thought. And I thought, well, you know, this, I've read Macworld since I was an early teenager.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. Right. So I had spent all my time reading it. And I thought, well, maybe he's got some suggestions. So I emailed him kind of blindly and said, do you have any tips for, someone who was interested in getting into writing about technology? And he was very nice, spent a generous amount of time writing a reply, gave me all these suggestions. and I never really followed them very well, which I feel guilty about to this day because he was very generous with his time. But it emboldened me enough to decide to eventually quit my job and think maybe I could just figure out something that I should be doing. And while I was unemployed, I decided I had always wanted to go to Macworld Expo. I had gotten a chance to go to one of the Boston ones because I grew up in Boston in the early 90s. I think it might have been the one where the Newton was introduced, actually. But I'd only like walked around the show floor. I hadn't gotten to go to the keynote or anything like that. And of course, I'd been an avid follower of Apple as I was still a huge Mac head. So I thought, you know, I'd really love to go to a Steve Jobs keynote. And so I went out to Macworld Expo in San Francisco in January of 2006, and I got to sit in an overflow room for a Steve Jobs keynote, which is pretty close. I actually saw Steve Jobs as I was going down the escalator onto the show floor afterwards. He was being ushered over to the expo floor, and I got within a few feet of him. Not my only close encounter with Steve Jobs, but my earliest one. And while I was at the expo, I happened to find a panel with Jason Snell on it. And I went up to talk to him. And I think I've related this story a number of times, but I basically asked him point blank if he had any jobs, which was, again, kind of a bold, entitled thing to do at that point. But he's like, no, we don't have any jobs, but we're starting up this blog called Mac User. Because, of course, they had merged with the old Mac User magazine a few years prior to that. And I said, that sounds cool. I'd love to do that. And so he gave me a little tryout, and I started working, blogging for them in March 2006 or so. And at that point, we got paid the very princely sum of $7 for a blog post, which awesome. Was, yeah, like rolling in the money there. And they told me, don't write more than 100 posts in a month. And so I wrote 100 posts because I figured they gave me the limit. I should do that. And I kept doing that for a while. And I guess I wrote well enough that they decided this guy seems like he knows what he's doing. So they started, you know, offering me some other assignments here and there. I spent a long time that first year reviewing iPod cases. And that was kind of a going concern.
So so get some experience.
Yeah,
exactly. Be bold. Ask and ask.
Yeah. Yeah, that's you know what? I've gotten a lot of places in life just by asking people things nicely, politely. You got to be polite and respectful.
That's
cannot
right.
Enthusiastic. Cannot emphasize that enough. Don't be a jerk. Nobody likes a jerk. But, you know, stand up for yourself and take those opportunities. So from there, it was kind of a downhill roll as I picked up steam, and they got me doing more assignments for Macworld on sort of a freelance basis. And then about a year and change after I started freelancing for them, they said, you know what, it's just cheaper to hire you. So I started there as an associate editor in mid-2007 and spent the next many, many years, 7 years working at Macworld.
A glorious run it was.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I got to know you, or at least from a distance, and admire your writing.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. That was really, for me, what a great time to be at Macworld. What a fantastic group of people that I got to work with while I was there.
Who were some of the people who you were working with? I know it was Jason.
Jason, you know, who was my mentor and who I worked very closely with on a bunch of projects. Dan Frakes, who is now over at the Wirecutter.
Of course.
Chris Breen, who is now at Apple.
Serenity?
Serenity. Yep.
She's on her way to Apple. You know.
Yeah, I know. I hired her back in the day as a freelancer on the Mac User blog when I was running it later.
Mm-hmm.
Lex Friedman too. I hired him and worked with him for a long time. Still, he's one of my podcast partners nowadays. Dan Miller, Roman Loyola, Sholly McFarland, Kelly Turner, just like. Jackie Dove, just, you know, all these people. Phil Michaels, another one of my longtime bosses there, who now works at Tom's Guide and was sort of the news editor for a long time and later the executive editor of the online department. Just a great resource, really savvy guy who knows the journalism business like nobody else. So just like a fantastic group of people most of whom I still keep at least some touch with, which is great. And it was just a fantastic time to learn from all these people. I could hardly leave out the two guys who basically taught me the ropes of reporting, which was Jim Dalrymple and Peter Cohen. And I learned so much from those guys because they had been doing this for so long, and they'd really like kind of built their own brand up back when they were still doing Mac Central. And then they came over to Macworld. And, you know, Jim especially is, you know, he always had a way of just finding out things and knew all the people. And he used to call me up and just give me tips and like talk to me about like how this business works and stuff like that. And it was invaluable because I didn't have any training in journalism. I'd never expected to be a journalist. And so I had to learn again, like sort of with my programming and tech career, I had to learn that all on the fly. Like I knew how to put a sentence together, but. Yeah, it was a learning on the job experience.
Fabulous. I had never heard the story of pre-Macworld, and now we all know. That's a great story. Thanks. Hey, we're coming to the end of the first segment. In the second segment, I want to ask you about life after Macworld and your sci-fi career and your podcasting. But first, we have to take a short commercial break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us. I'm chatting with novelist and freelance writer Dan Morin. We'll be right back.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you. I'm chatting with Dan Morin. So tell me about life after Macworld. You are partnering with Jason Snell at Six Colors. Did you guys cook that up together?
No, that was Jason's idea. In 2014, in September, actually right after the Apple Watch was first introduced, I was out in San Francisco to cover the event. And the next day I got called into a big meeting with a bunch of my colleagues and a bunch of us got laid off.
I remember that. We were all wondering why they all sent you out for this big event and did all this reporting. And then when you came back and got the bad news.
Yeah, it was nice for me too, because I was on, you know, like I live in Boston. So I flew out there and then the next had to fly back thinking I don't have a job anymore.
Oh, man.
But, you know, Jason and I obviously very close colleagues and friends. And he mentioned, you know, I'm going to go do a blog. A Mac blog so I can do things, you know, the way I want to do them rather than having to be a part of a big corporation as we had been. And he invited me to come and contribute. I really didn't know what I was going to do next at that point. And I love working with Jason. So it seemed like kind of a natural move for me. I've been doing that ever since. We put out, you know, we blog fairly regularly. We put out a monthly magazine for subscribers. We have a membership program going now. We do a little podcast for our members. And it's fun. It's a good way to keep talking about Apple and thinking about Apple in a environment that's a little more casual, unstructured than, you know, your traditional magazine. So it's kind of a switch for me because, you know, after all that time, you know, working with colleagues, you know, all those people I named, and working in an environment where things were a little more structured and you had a specific role and there were specific things you had to do and the ways you had to do them. It was kind of nice to change that up and go into an environment where it was like, hey, you know, we can do this however we want. We can write about whatever we want. We can cover it the way we want. We don't have to cover all the things that we had to cover at Macworld. It was a nice change, and it really, the freedom and flexibility has been enormous for me, especially as I've, you know, tried to have a freelance writing career on the side there. Like, it's nice to have Six Colors as part of my output.
What do you like to write about most? You have a favorite subject?
I really enjoy doing sort of like how to and tip stuff for me. Like my background at Macworld was mainly news. Like that was news and op-ed was the stuff I did the most. But I like writing about how to get the most out of your technology. To me, that's one of the fun parts. Like, I know a lot of people complain about having to do tech support for their family, but I actually don't mind. I actually like, you know, helping them make it work better, right? Like, people come to you with frustrations. And this was my IT career as well. People came to you and like, oh, I mean, this isn't working right. I'm annoyed. And it's like, I want to be the one to help them get unannoyed and have the thing do the thing that it's supposed to. So for me, that's the most rewarding, is to write up something, a way of doing something that people are like, oh, that's great. I wanted to know how to do that.
Are you kind of a Mac first person? And can I ask you what kind of a Mac you write with?
I have my iOS devices, but the Mac is still remained for me the way I get most of my work done.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, I have two, my daily machine that I'm talking to you on right now, which is mainly sort of my podcasting rig, is an iMac 5K I bought last year. So brand new, great machine, love it. But I still do most of my writing on my 11-inch MacBook Air, which I adore, and I fear will someday be left in the dust as Apple discontinues the MacBook Air line. My only complaint about my MacBook Air is that it doesn't have a Retina display. If it did, yeah, I would just keep it forever.
I have a 2015 MacBook, and it's got a 12-inch screen instead of 13, and it's just a little too cramped for me. And I've been thinking, boy, I sure could like a 13-inch screen for my notebook computer.
Yeah, so, yeah.
But otherwise, I think that MacBook is glorious. I love it.
Yeah, I'm tempted by it because that's a step up over my 11-inch MacBook Air even. But I love the size of the 11-inch on especially when I go on planes. It just fits so nicely on the tray tables and takes up so little space.
What tools do you use to write? Do you just use a text editor or do you have something more sophisticated that you use?
For fiction, my predominant tool is Scrivener.
Yay!
I've been That's using it awesome for many, tool. Many years.
Yeah.
It's fantastic. I don't even use, I'm sure I don't use 80% of the features in it, but it works for me. I have, very specific ways that I like to organize my novel writing. And having recently worked a little bit with a friend of mine who's also a novelist and seeing that he also uses Scrivener but uses it totally differently, I just love that it's that flexible a program.
And it'll export in DocX for those fussy publishers, right?
Yeah, DocX. I also generate EPUBs and MOBI files with it so I can read stuff on readers. I can look at a draft and give it to my beta readers and say, here, go read it on your Kindle. Go read it on your iPad. Whatever you want, I can provide. That's my favorite feature of Scrivener, far and away, is just how flexible.
We reviewed it. We all use it. We love it. It's an excellent app.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, most of my Macworld columns are still written in the same tool that I wrote my Macworld pieces in when I was there, which is BBEdit. Another time honored.
Same here. Same here. I write my columns every day at Mac Observer and BBEdit. And then
it's
a great HTML tool. Markup with BBEdit and just drop it into WordPress.
Yep. I do Markdown and basically the same idea. I just write up my stuff in Markdown, convert it to HTML, and there we go. Yeah. So it's a great tool. And I do, for Six Colors, I use Mars Edit by my friend Daniel Jalkut, which is a great little blogging tool that is just, it's basically the easiest way to publish stuff to your blog. So I love it. And I've been using that on and off for a long time as well.
Okay, we got to move on.
All right.
You've been writing some science fiction lately. I assume you've been a longtime science fiction reader. Who are some of the writers who inspired you?
Well, going back a long ways, I've had a bunch of different inspirations for writers. I've been, an avid sci-fi reader since I was a kid, and fantasy as well. When I was a kid, the Dark is Rising series by Susan Cooper, which is kind of a YA fantasy, was one of my favorites. And of course, I read Tolkien and I read Asimov, all the classic stuff. In more recent years, the ones that have had huge impacts on me, and I talk about this a lot, but there's an author named Lois McMaster Bujold, who's written a series called The Vorkosigan Saga, which is this sort of sprawling space adventure, space opera series that's 30-odd years old.
Oh, yeah, I love those.
It's great. It is just, it's a lot of fun. It's very human too, which is one of my favorite things about it. Her characterizations are fantastic.
I can see how that influenced you.
Yeah. And that's that really pointed to something. When I started reading those in college, I started thinking, oh, I'd love to write something like this. And I started jotting down notes for the idea that would eventually become my first novel, even though I sort of put them aside for a while after that and didn't really get to working in earnest on that book until it was 2009 or so was really when I started drafting the book as it currently stands.
I just had Stephen Bruce on the show a couple of weeks ago, and he was inspired by Roger Zelazny's Lord of Light.
Oh, yeah.
And it just had a total impact on him when he was younger. And he said, I want to write like that. And he did.
Yeah, and that's fantastic.
Very successful. So you had published your first sci-fi novel, The Caledonian Gambit. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the plot and tell me about why that book got written.
Yeah, so the plot of this book is basically it's set against the backdrop of this galactic Cold War. And it follows this operative from one side named Simon Kavalik, who recruits this washed up pilot named Eli Brody.
Not Han Solo.
No. Now, Brody is not quite like Solo. He's a little bit more, he's seen some stuff. He was in a bad battle and he's got a little bit of shell shock. And he's basically been away from his home for a long time. But Kavalik comes looking for him because he's got a problem that only Brody can fix, which is he's been running Brody's brother as sort of an intelligence asset, and he's disappeared. So he needs Brody to go home to his planet that he left behind because he went off to see the galaxy and fly spaceships, and needs to go home and patch things up with his brother, who he did not leave on good terms with. But of course, there's some twists, some turns. There's, you know, at this sort of terrorist organization that has been causing trouble and is potentially tipping this war from a cold war into a hot war. And Kovalik and his team are trying to keep the peace, trying to keep things steady and so that another open conflict doesn't break out. So it's inspired as much by science fiction as it is my love of also espionage stories like John le Carré and sort of all those classic Cold War spy stories. With a dash of your Mission Impossible thrown in as well.
Sounds like a great novel. Do you see it as an ongoing thing? Is there going to be a sequel maybe?
I would, you know, this is where I always take a playbook, a piece from Apple's playbook and say, I don't have anything to announce about that right now.
Well, you know, like you, I had to ask.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I've gotten a lot of great feedback for the book and a lot of people clamoring for another book. And I hope to have something to tell those people in the not too distant future. I know I feel like I've been saying that for a while now, but the publishing is a world that moves very slowly sometimes. So it's hard to know exactly when you'll be able to talk about things that have been in the works for a long time.
I've had some conversations with Charlie Strauss and with Stephen Bruce about cover art, and that's always an interesting topic. Are you happy with the cover art done for you?
Yeah, I love the cover art for my first book. Is fantastic. The artist is a guy named Sebastian Hugh, and I remember when I had the conversation with my editor about it, and I didn't think I had sort of been trained to think. You know what? Just you roll with it. If you get a good cover, that's great. If you get a bad cover, you know what? Just keep going. You know, don't let it get you down. I did not expect to have much in the way of input, but my editor at Talos, who published The Caledonian Gambit, came to me and said, what do you see on the cover? Like, got any thoughts about it?
Wow, that's nice.
Yeah, and I was kind of taken aback because I wasn't really ready for this. So I like scrambled and came up with some other art that I liked. And I ended up, this is a story I've told on my blog too, but I drew the idea in my head of what I'd kind of thought it would look like on my iPad. And I am not a good artist. It looks like a 5-year-old's depiction. And I sent that to my editor saying like, oh, this is kind of what I had in mind. And, you know, a few weeks later when he got back to me with this sketch for the cover, and I was just blown away because they had taken like sort of the barest of bones of my idea, just like, there are some spaceships here. There's this big wormhole gate in the background. Yeah. And they had turned it into this fully fleshed out, beautiful cover. And I love the way it came out. I have to say, one of these things, I have the full image, like it's cropped a little bit for the cover. I have the full image in a file somewhere that they sent me. And it's one of these moments I'm going to get it done as like a huge print or something, because I think it's gorgeous.
Excellent. Excellent. I've heard the book is doing very well.
I like to think so. I will take whatever you've heard. It's always hard to gauge with publishing. It's a weird industry. You kind of have to not worry too much about the sales and just move on to the next thing, because you could spend all your time refreshing Amazon and checking all your reviews. But at the end of the day, it's hard to know exactly how well it's doing. There's no, until you get that royalty statement or not, like, you know, you don't really know numbers. And I think it's been done very well. I don't think that it's been either a, you know, you're not going to see it on the New York Times bestseller list immediately, but it didn't do badly either. So I think it's done very solidly. I'm very happy. I'm very proud of it. And I'm looking forward to moving on to my next projects.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we're starting to run out of time just a little bit, so we have to move on. Next topic I wanted to ask you about was your podcasts. You do a lot of podcasting. Tell me about all the podcasts you're on. For the listeners who aren't familiar with them, can you kind of give me sort of a rundown and so what they're all about?
Yeah, absolutely. My podcasting career goes back to my time at Macworld. I mean, obviously, I was on the Macworld podcast a little bit when I was there. In August of 2010, so almost eight years ago now, Jason Snell and a few of our other friends were all talking about science fiction books and how we were interested in discussing them. And I think Jason suggested we should do a podcast. And podcasting was just starting to come into its own at that point. And from that discussion, The Incomparable started. And this has been our long-running podcast that's got a rotating panel and now a huge crew of people who have participated in it, that does all sorts of nerdy pop culture. We talk about movies, books, games, video games, comic books, pretty much anything that's even adjacent to sort of like genre or nerdy pop culture. It's now become a huge network under Jason's watchful eye. And I do a bunch of other shows there as well. I do a show called Not Playing with Lex and Dan with my friend Lex Friedman, where we watch popular movies that one of us hasn't seen before. And we've been doing that for a long time, although we sort of go in and out. We do about a season a year now of a half dozen episodes or so. I do a weekly recap show on the TV show Arrow when it's on with my friends John Moltz and Guy English. And I also run, write, produce, and host a nerdy trivia show called Inconceivable, which is a panel show where two teams face off and answer trivia questions that I've devised.
Kelly Dumont said that was hysterically funny.
Yeah, it was so nice to hear Kelly during the ad read there, but Kelly's been on it a few times and has always acquitted herself very well. It's a lot of fun. It's one I've done it live a couple times, and that to me is just a blast. It's just so much fun to do it in front of an audience. I wish I had more of an opportunity to do it, but I'll take what I can get.
There's one other called Clockwise. Tell me about
There's actually two tech podcasts I do regularly. One of them is Clockwise, which is over at the Relay FM network. Clockwise actually started when Jason and I were still at Macworld. The parent company IDG launched a consumer tech blog called TechHive, and they wanted a podcast to go with it. And Jason and I pitched them on this idea of a show that was never more than 30 minutes, where we had himself and myself as the co-hosts, two guests that changed every week, and everybody brought a topic that we could talk about. And so it's been going since then. We were very lucky to be able to take it with us when we left Macworld and to move it over to Relay. Jason has since left the show, but Micah Sargent of IMOR and a variety of other podcasts has joined me as co-host. And we just recorded our 250th episode this week. So wow. It's been going for a while.
Amazing. We'll put links in the show notes.
Yeah. And I also do a show called The Rebound with my friends Lex Friedman and John Moltz, which started right around the time I left Macworld, decided to want to do a tech podcast. And John and Lex and I are all very good friends and share sort of a similar irreverent view of technology. So we record that. That one's coming up on our 200th episode in a few weeks. And it's a delight. It's fun to talk to those guys every week and just, you know, just shoot the breeze about technology.
That's a lot of podcasts, but it sounds like a lot of fun too.
It is. It is. It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of work. I edit and produce a lot of these shows in addition to being on them, and, you know, deal with all the logistics and scheduling and all that fun stuff. So, you know how much work it can be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a lot of fun though. I enjoy the heck out of doing it. And again, podcasting was not something that existed when either of us were younger. So it's cool to be a part of that as a burgeoning, increasingly popular media.
Do you see that as someday replacing the written word, or is it going to remain in a supplement only?
I don't think it'll replace it. I mean, the written word's been around for thousands upon thousands of years. I don't see it going anywhere fast. But, you know, in the same way that television didn't displace movies and neither of them displaced radio, I think podcasting has a vibrant career ahead of it. But I don't think it's going to necessarily get rid of anything else.
We have time for one more subject, maybe a minute or a minute and a half. I wanted to ask you, since you're an expert on all things Apple, I'm springing this on you out of the blue. How do you feel about Apple and the resurgence of the Mac with the iMac Pro and the new MacBook Pros? You think they're back on track?
I'm bullish on it. I'm really looking forward to seeing what they do with the Mac Pro, which they've hinted is coming next year. Very excited for that. I feel good about the Mac. You know, I've seen Phil Schiller and others talk about the Mac going on forever. I know a lot of people worry about it getting swallowed up by iOS devices because they're so big, but I think, you know, the Mac, again, it's survived for, you know, 30, they're almost 40 years. You know, I think it's got a lot of time left in it, a lot of gas left in the tank, and I'm very excited. I love my iMac 5K. It's a great machine. They clearly know what they're doing with hardware, at least on the desktop side. They've had some challenges on the laptop side, but nothing they can't overcome. So I'm excited for the future there.
I am too. I think the iMac Pro sort of punctuated the beginning of the relaunch of the Mac. And I'm, like you, I'm excited to see what the new Mac Pro is like. I'm talking to you on a 2013 Mac Pro. Mm. And heaven knows I won't be able to afford the next one. So I'm going to have to figure out what to do next when this one gets really old. So.
Well, fingers crossed it'll last a couple more years for you.
Yeah, until I can buy a Mac Pro I can afford, if ever. Yeah. So I'm kind of partial to desktop Macs. Well, we really are out of time now, so we're going to have to kind of close things down. Well, thank you very much for joining me. It's been fun.
My pleasure. The time just flew by. This was a great conversation.
It really did. It was a lot of fun, too. So tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Yeah, you can always find me on Twitter at DMorin, and you can contact me via my website, which is DMorin.com. Easy to remember.
All right, cool. Well, it was a pleasure chatting with you and hearing about your writing career. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, John.
Listeners, thanks for coming by as well. I hope you enjoyed the show. You've been listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. I'll see you next week.